Well, here he is.
Speaking of me, right? Thank you.
All right,
sorry about that.
All right, we'll have the marshal call the calendar then.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Johnson, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Judge Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning, counsel. The case before us is the case of Washington Jimenez Moncayo versus Ashley Davis et al. File numbers A201218. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument and identify your client. And the appellant may proceed at this time.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, I'm Scott Wilson, and together with Jordan Kalinske, who is present with us today, I represent Appellant Washington Jimenez Moncayo. Before I get started, I just wanted to point out two simple typos in the reply brief that I ran into when I was preparing for today that could cause confusion. One is at our reply brief, page 9, there's an indented quotation of the Sullivan case. And in that indented quotation, there's a parenthetical quoting the Bollmeyer case. The phrase refused to consider should be inserted between the words correctly and materials in that parenthetical. So it says something like the court correctly refused to consider materials, et cetera. And then the other one I wanted to point out was footnote 10 in that brief at page 17 should reference our footnote 6, not footnote 4. So having said that, Rule 60 relief, the Rule 60 relief requested in this case should have been granted. As the court knows, four factors under the Findon case are determinative of relief from judgment under Rule 60.02a, which is the kind of Rule 60 relief you get for inadvertent errors of this type. Here, three of those four factors are clearly satisfied. And by the way, I know that that's contrary to what the district court found, but I assert on this record it is nonetheless clearly true.
Can I ask you this before we get started? I mean, in order to prevail on a Rule 60 motion, isn't it true that you have to satisfy all four factors?
Indeed, and we did. My point here, and maybe I might have said it a little better or a little more completely, my point here is that three of the four are satisfied, I assert respectfully, beyond dispute. And then the last factor is also satisfied. It's just, that's the debatably meritorious claim factor. That just, we just have to talk about that a little bit because unfortunately the standard for that factor isn't entirely clear under Minnesota law. And I think that's really what this case is about, is figuring out what that standard is and applying it correctly to the full record that was provided to Judge Klein below.
Mr. Wilson, I guess before we go there, I'd like to talk about the second requirement, reasonable excuse. I think that's not so clear myself. I mean, why was it, in light of the language of Rule 5, why was it reasonable? Or why was it a reasonable, what reasonable excuse is there for plaintiff's counsel below to have not filed it within 1 year of the earlier service?
Well, there's a cinch, Judge Johnson, that no flat-out mistake like the one that Mr. Kalinske committed here is reasonable. Mr. Kalinske should have filed the case on time. The reason that he didn't file the case on time, and this goes to the heart of the reasonable excuse element, the reason he didn't file it on time is because he made an inadvertent error in calendaring the initiating date for the one-year period under 504. There were two defendants to serve. He had some trouble finding one of them. He served one in February of 2019, and he served the one he had trouble finding in Arizona in March of 2019. He then made his mistake, which is that he calendared the second commencement date, the second service date, and his existence system, his legal his law practice management system, then triggered him a month late. That's right. Not justifiable. It is, however, inadvertent. Now, go ahead. I've got a more complete answer for your question, but I don't want to interrupt you.
I'll let you finish. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Here's why that scenario clearly satisfies the reasonable excuse element. It satisfies it clearly in the full context of the law. In Minnesota, our courts have over and over said that there is a strong presumption that the client is not to be penalized for counsel's inadvertent error. And the reason it's clearly satisfied here is because there is two things. First, there is nothing in the case to defeat that presumption. And secondly, there is no explanation offered by the district court as to why it found the element lacking. And given the strength of that presumption, and strong is the adjective that this and other courts in Minnesota have chosen, given the strength of that presumption and the absence of anything in the record that would take us in a different direction, some explanation is warranted from the district court, and there is none.
It seems like by your reasoning, then, it seems like perhaps every case in which there's a failure under Rule 5, a failure to timely file under Rule 5 by the attorney. I mean, this is an action, obviously, with represented parties that is always undertaken by the attorney. But it seems like, by your reasoning, every such case would satisfy the second requirement. But the Supreme Court said in Gams and Cole that it did mention the principle about not punishing the client for the lawyer's mistake, but it also said not every mistake is excusable, and that it's always a case-by-case, fact-dependent determination based on the circumstances.
That's correct. And I think I get an assist here from respondent, who cites a case that's a good example of where an error under 504 is not excusable. And let me see if I can... Yeah, Safeco Insurance Company versus Holmgren Building Repair is discussed by respondent at page 22 of their brief. And it's one of the few times I use the tables I prepare. Well, I discussed it and didn't manage to put it in my table. I apologize, but it is also, don't hang on, I'm in the wrong brief. It's discussed in our reply brief, pages 15 through 17. So I'm actually gonna jump back, Judge, answer your question in concept and then apply the Sullivan case to the issue. So you've got, in a circumstance where you've got a truly inadvertent error like this one under 504, which is a technical case management mechanism, not a jurisdictional mechanism, I would tend to agree with the concern that you raise, which is, I just don't see it as a concern. So you get an inadvertent error, you've got a technical case management rule like this one, the client's not involved in any way. In that circumstance, the presumption operates and the client is not to be punished. But in a circumstance like Safeco, where you've got a sophisticated client who is actively involved in the management of the case, and I believe in that case, what Safeco did is they continued to pretend like they were going to settle the case, and then they didn't follow through, and counsel got tangled up in that. And it was clear, at least to the district court, that Safeco's maneuvering around settlement led in substantial part to the failure of counsel. In that circumstance, there's a shared responsibility.
Let me, so you cited the Orr case, with which I'm familiar. I was on the panel. It's an unpublished opinion, which said that in that circumstance, there was an error with respect to the second requirement. I think the error in that case by the district court was that the district court applied a per se rule. Now I've done my own research. I've seen three or four subsequent unpublished opinions in which this court has affirmed decisions by district courts saying that, you know, under in a Rule 5 situation where district courts said that was not a reasonable excuse, and this court has affirmed. I'm thinking of Lusky, Curtin, and Larson. And I think in each of those cases, or at least in two of them, there was simply a matter of, you know, the plaintiff's lawyer in a similar manner made a mistake in either being aware of or in applying the Rule 5 requirement. I don't know if you did not cite those. You're not obligated to cite them. I'm just wondering if you have seen them. But those cases to me indicate that this court, I think, more often has taken the approach contrary to Orr, if Orr is understood to be similar here.
I am aware of at least some of the cases that you cited, and yes, I'm not distinguishing them either because they're not raised or because they're non-precedential. But and of course, here I am with Orr in my own footnote. But what I would say to you is those unpublished decisions, to the extent that they are penalizing the client for counsel's inadvertent error under Rule 504, and there isn't something extra like there is in the Safeco case, I would look you straight in the eye, Judge, and tell you those cases are incorrect. Because what the published decisional law says, both at the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, what that law says, the precedential law, is that there is this strong presumption. And in fact, in the context of a technical failure, as opposed to a jurisdictional failure, I assert that makes sense.
That sounds like a per se rule.
I think where there is no intersection between the client's behavior and counsel's behavior, yes, I think you're left with a per se rule in the context of a technical failure like this one, as opposed to a jurisdictional one.
But I mean, didn't the Supreme Court say there are no per se rules? I mean, I thought that was very clear from Gams and Cole. There are no per se rules here.
I think, you know, if I've crossed myself up with the Supreme Court, obviously that's not very good for me. My understanding of Gams and Cole is that they are saying that you've got to, you've got to look on a case-by-case basis. But I assert that what you're looking for is something like what you see in Safeco.
Well, could I ask you this? I mean, sure. I understand Safeco involved a more sophisticated party, but in this case, we do have an appellant who basically had met with an attorney and a suit was brought on his behalf. But the respondent makes a point of saying that there was absolutely nothing that went on in this case for almost a year. And wouldn't you think under those circumstances that the appellant, who's got a great interest in the case, would want to follow up on that and see why he hasn't been deposed or why he hasn't participated in any way in the lawsuit or what the status is? I mean, wouldn't that failure to follow up be something that the judge could consider in determining whether this was excusable neglect or not?
It is something perhaps that the judge could consider. There is no evidence that the judge did consider it, and there is nothing in the record. As somebody who, before I became an appellate lawyer around 2002, I spent about 20 years at trial level practice. I wouldn't give myself the title trial lawyer, but I practiced at that level and in the personal injury field. And I can tell you that there's typically a lot of communication going on between contingently represented clients and counsel, often too much to manage. So there may very well have been communication. We honestly don't know. And I'm not being coy with you. I don't know whether or not there was. What we have is a vacuum in the record.
Was there anything in the record relative to this motion that there had not been much discovery or anything done by the appellant and his attorney until just, briefly before the motion was brought?
That issue was dealt with at the trial level. And interestingly, and this is an unappealed finding, Judge Klein, that's the one issue on which Judge Klein ruled in our favor under the prejudice heading. He indicated that because discovery was underway in the case. And remember, in the context of the statute of limitations, well, I would agree with you, Judge, that it would be better to see a case move more quickly in the first year than what we saw in this case. Remember, this case is relatively promptly sued out and still well within the statute. So in the big picture, I would assert that you don't have a tremendous amount of dilatory behavior going on. The first year should have been better, should have been faster. Go ahead.
Only because, and I'm sorry, and maybe if you haven't finished your thought, I wanted to,
I'm close your time.
Okay, on the first factor, and I think you were about to start about it, would you agree, despite our deference, all affidavits should be considered? I understand the defense submitted an affidavit as well. And we don't have findings by the court that we, at least significant ones on that factor, but your point in your brief was that your client had submitted a factor and the response referred to defendant's affidavit as well.
Yeah, all affidavits should be considered. There's no question in my mind about that. I have 11 remaining seconds. I don't know that I have anything burning. I will simply assert in conclusion to my principal argument, just that that I think we've established in our brief that all four elements are met. The debatably meritorious claim element is the sort of the academically interesting one, but it's very thoroughly briefed. And if you agree with that assertion, then the district court does not have discretion to deny relief under the articulated standards we have. Thank you. I'll reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. The respondent may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Megan Cooper and I represent the respondents, Ashley Davis and Christine Lind. I would agree with the appellant to the extent that he has to meet all four factors, and his most problematic factor is the debatably meritorious claim in this case. I think he's made absolutely no showing on that claim and has not even a arguably weak possibility in that respect.
Even if we consider the affidavit of the plaintiff, which was submitted with the motion?
Well, and that was going to get me to my next point, Your Honor. There are actually two issues with respect to the debatably meritorious claim because they're different with respect to Christine Lind and Ashley Davis. So you have to look these require different evidence. With respect to Christine Lind, there's nothing. There's nothing that can be considered here in this case for her. The claim is that she was the owner of the vehicle and that's her only involvement. However, there's no evidence that she was the owner of the vehicle. The only even hearsay suggestions that she is involved is allegations that she is a co-owner, which really aren't based on real evidence. It's just based on some anecdotal observations that Ms. Davis and the plaintiff made. But there's no real evidence that she owned the vehicle. And so there's no evidence that she can be vicariously liable here.
Well, okay, and now you're referring to the plaintiff's affidavit filed in May of 2020, right? But where he says that he recounts statements made by, why does that not satisfy, or at least make it reasonably debatable that Christine Lind is an owner?
Well, it's very tenuous hearsay, first of all. And second of all, even if you take his statement at face value and true, which I submit to you shouldn't be because it's tenuous hearsay, it creates a co-owner relationship. And under the case Riddler versus Madsen, Christine Lind would not be legally responsible for the negligence or the permission given by a co-owner of the vehicle. So even if you take that statement to be true, which again, I submit we should not, because it's so tenuous here, even that will not get the plaintiff a reasonably meritorious claim or debatably meritorious claim with respect to Christine Lind. There's really nothing for her other than some vague insinuation that she's a co-owner, which isn't enough under the law.
What about Defendant Davis?
All right, that brings me to Defendant Davis. I think the case law here in this is clear that when there are competing affidavits or competing evidence, the district court has broad discretion to evaluate that evidence. In this case, there were two affidavits, and the judge had that discretion to evaluate them to determine if there was a debatably meritorious claim. I know appellant would like the court to believe that all he has to do is state that there's a claim that somehow was vaguely, nebulously out there, but that's not what the law says. The law says it has to be a meritorious claim. And so in that vein, Judge Klein certainly had discretion to evaluate the evidence, evaluate these two affidavits. The plaintiff's statements, he makes a lot of statements with respect to vicarious liability, but with respect to just liability of Ms. Lind, he makes very short, conclusory statements. When compared to Ms. Davis's affidavit, she provides considerably more information, very detailed information, and it was well within Judge Klein's discretion to determine that with respect to Ms. Davis, there was not a debatably meritorious claim, and the plaintiff and the appellant failed on that issue.
So I think what you're saying is that
if there's a
genuine issue of material fact that would preclude summary judgment, that doesn't necessarily preclude the judge in that situation may step in and resolve that dispute one way or another in the judge's discretion for purposes of the first Findon requirement. Is that what you're saying? And if so, I guess, is there any case law authority that says that exactly?
Yes, there is. In my brief, I believe it's the, I'm not sure how to, I'm not very good at pronouncing this one, and I apologize. Rordaz versus Brill. There's a statement that when there's competing affidavits or evidence, it is within the district court's, in a Rule 60.02 motion, it's within the district court's discretion to evaluate that evidence to determine if the factors have been met. Here, it was the appellant's burden to meet the factors. And so the judge could perform, as set forth by the case law, his duty of evaluating the evidence and determine that the plaintiff failed to meet the debatably meritorious claim with respect to both Ms. Lind and Ms. Davis, again, for different reasons. Yes, that's the position we're taking.
Well, can I ask you, what is the standard that the court should utilize in making this determination? If it was a Rule 12 standard, we would assume all the facts as indicated in the complaint were true.
I thought you were done.
So if we use the Rule 12 standard, wouldn't there be a debatably meritorious claim under that rule?
Well, there's conflicting case law, you're correct, that says that it hasn't been determined whether that's enough. So it's kind of an open question of law as to whether relying on the complaint is sufficient. However, in the cases where the complaint is relied upon, it also is clear that it can't be merely conclusory statements. So I think that takes it out of the realm of Rule 12, because it can't just, they have to be a determination of whether it's conclusory, and it says in the case law that it hasn't been determined yet whether that's sufficient. So I believe that's an open question for law. And then when combined with this other case law that says it's within the court's discretion, if there's competing evidence, I think it's certainly above a Rule 12 standard.
Well, is it above a summary judgment standard? Because couldn't with the evidence that was before this judge, wouldn't it be enough to maybe deny a summary judgment on behalf of your client, but say that there are disputed facts as to how this occurred, and therefore it's by finding that there would be a colorable meritorious claim.
The case law sets forth a different standard here. The appellant has to meet these four factors. The appellant has the burden of meeting each of the factors. And the case law says that if there's competing evidence or conclusory statements, the judge can make a determination. And so the standard is different than summary judgment according to the case law.
So is it a more likely than not standard? They have to prove every element? You see the confusion here? So is the judge going to have a mini trial in order to determine this motion?
I do see the confusion here. And unfortunately, I'm not here to make up a standard that the courts haven't set forth. And the courts, all I can do is tell you the case law that's been determined, and it's clearly more than a Rule 12. And it's also different than a summary judgment based upon the case law that exists. And so I'd say based on the case law that exists today, it's clear that even with respect to Ms. Davis, the appellant failed to meet his burden under the first factor.
Well, Ms. Cooper, could I
Oh, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I just wanted to jump to the second factor and to understand your client's viewpoint with regard to that. It seems undisputed, and you can tell me if your client would dispute it. It's undisputed that it was solely an attorney error, and there's no refuting it was the clerical calendaring issue. So since we know the law is seems fairly clear in this area that court should be loath to assign the error of an attorney and a sole error of an attorney on a client, it seems like that's exactly the facts here that we'd be reviewing in terms of an abuse of discretion. Is this what's unique about this that we should accept the loathing and affirm on that factor?
Your Honor, I agree that that is the only excuse that's been put forth as to why the if they failed to file timely. I don't necessarily agree that Judge Klein, to speak informally, bought that excuse.
Aren't we limited to our abuse of discretion? There's no findings to suggest anything other than that. Am I correct in that?
That is correct. He just said that the claimed excuse is not reasonable. And I would submit to you that Judge Klein also considered all of the arguments made at the motion before him. And if you look at the transcript of that hearing, it's clear that Judge Klein was put off because the plaintiff or the appellant's counsel at that clearly was not just taking responsibility and saying this is because of my mistake. He was clearly attempting to blame the defendants for his failure. There's pages of him blaming, and then there's an exchange with Judge Klein where Judge Klein told him that his arguments were falling flat and it didn't seem appropriate to be blaming the defendant for the appellant's failures. And so, while yes, that's the excuse that's put forth, that's not necessarily what was argued and heard by Judge Klein. And he said that he does not think their claimed excuse is reasonable. And I believe a lot of that had to do with their conduct and as set forth in the transcript.
Wouldn't that suggest then the court is considering factors it ought not to and bring it back to the only factor that's in the record and it's undisputed, which then brings in the loathing law that I'm referring to?
I think that whether or not Judge Klein is in the best position to determine the accuracy and the believability of the claimed excuse. I think the arguments that went to the believability and the credibility of the counsel and the excuse, and the judge could easily find that it wasn't. And I mean, and as discussed earlier, it would essentially create a per se rule that this number two factor is always met, even when there's a situation as in here where the excuse comes into question during oral arguments, and it would all just always simply be met, which I don't think is the standard here. It has to be a case-by-case determination as to whether the excuse is believable and reasonable. And here the judge was within his discretion to determine it wasn't.
Could I just clarify one thing with regard to factor four? You didn't cross appeal as to the judge's ruling on that factor, which was against your client. Am I correct?
I did not cross appeal on that factor.
So our consideration is with regard to the first three factors, correct?
I did not cross appeal. I believe that the plaintiff appealed the ruling. And so all factors are essentially all up for appeal, but I did not cross appeal on that factor.
All right. So the judge's finding on that that's undisputed.
Well,
upon review.
Well, it is our position that the judge should be given great discretion based upon the procedural posture of the case. It is defendants or the respondents' position that they were prejudiced, especially by the withholding of the Ashley Davis communications when we believed she had not been served. and they withheld her affidavit and her answer for 13 months. It is our position that there was some prejudice there, but also I recognize that Judge Klein had broad discretion and he ruled against us there.
Okay. Ms. Cooper, with respect to the first requirement, whether there is, the case law asks whether there is a debatably meritorious claim. Here we have two claims, two defendants, one claim against each defendant, essentially. Must the plaintiff establish that both are debatably meritorious, or is it sufficient for plaintiff to establish that one, at least one of the two, is debatably meritorious?
It's our position that she must establish both. She's attempting to reinstate a claim against both defendants, and she must be able to have a debatably meritorious claim against both of them.
What's the authority for that?
I don't believe there's any case law that addresses that particular issue, but I don't see how she can prevail in an appeal against Ms. Lind if Ms. Lind, there's no claim against her, if there's no debatably meritorious claim against her.
Is it conceivable that in this situation, with this kind of a motion and this kind of a case, that the district court would not grant all the relief or none of the relief, but conceivable the district court could have and should have ordered partial relief, saying, you have relief from the judgment with respect to this defendant, but not with respect to that defendant? Is that something that was on the table?
I don't agree that it should have happened, but I think that was certainly within the district court's power to grant relief with respect to one of the defendants and not the other.
And so do you believe we should consider that as well?
Well, I don't think that the appellant should prevail against either of them. However, I think that is also within your power.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? Very good.
Well, all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Judge Johnson, I did not exactly cover myself with glory discussing the Cole versus Woodski case with you during my principal argument. So naturally, I went back and read it. And you're right down there at the end of the passage, it says, accordingly, there are no per se rules of law requiring either the grant or denial of a Rule 602 a motion. And it's in the context of the reasonable excuse factor. So what I said to you about per se rules is just wrong. But here's what the court does do in Cole versus Woodski that's important here. The passage on reasonable excuse occurs in two paragraphs. And the first paragraph, they assert what Judge Sleater referred to as the loathing law, the strong presumption that we don't punish clients for inadvertent errors of counsel. And then it goes right into something you see in a lot of cases, not just Cole. We've cautioned not all mistakes are subject to relief. And it actually cites a 19th century case, Baxter. And then eventually it gets down to the accordingly, there are no per se rules of law language. But here's the heart of the analysis in Cole. What the court says after it says, not all mistakes are excusable, it is generally for the district court to determine whether the excuse offered by the movement is true and reasonable under the circumstances. And what I'm asserting here is that what Judge Klein did below, what the district court did below, doesn't pass muster with that determination under an abuse of discretion standard. We've got a purely inadvertent error of counsel and a vacuum in the record as to anything that would connect that up with the client. We've shown for purposes of this record that the excuse is true and reasonable under the circumstances, I assert. So that's my response there. Sorry, I got the case law wrong. You asked counsel during her argument whether or not the district court could resolve the fact question, which is really the first factor, the debatably meritorious claim question, whether the court could resolve that at its discretion. And in the way that I was hearing you, I thought you asked, could it resolve that at its discretion in a way that might exceed a judge's scope on a summary judgment inquiry. So I did get that right. And she cited Roordans to you. And I briefed this fairly carefully in the reply brief, but I want to emphasize it here. Roordans is not apposite. Roordans doesn't address the debatably meritorious claim element. What the court did in Roordans was it sorted out conflicting affidavits as to the existence of a reasonable excuse. So Roordans is not, that case is not a test for whether or not there is some standard beyond the summary judgment standard that might apply to this determination.
Are you aware of any other authority on that question?
I looked really hard and I did not find anything in Minnesota. Except for this, a conceptual argument, which is this. The Supreme Court has clearly sidestepped the question of whether or not affidavits are necessary. They have, on at least twice, I think in Charson and in Gams, said we're not deciding whether or not the movement needs to submit an affidavit. If the standard was actually at the summary judgment level or above it, that wouldn't be a question. Because if you've got a standard that is at or in excess of the summary judgment standard, you have got to have affidavits. So there's no question to resolve. You move over to federal court and you do have an answer. In federal court, they apply the summary judgment standard. Although one or two federal courts do ratchet the standard back down to something more like a Rule 12 standard, where you're in the circumstance we're in here, where discovery is not complete and the parties have not had a full opportunity to establish a prima facie claim.
Forgive me, but I'm interested in that. Did you cite those federal cases in either of your briefs? I can't remember.
I did indeed. They were discussed in the reply brief.
I'm sure I'll find it.
Yeah, well, here it is. Pages 3 to 8 is where we did the exploration of federal law and some other law on that question in the reply brief. The last thing I want to address in the 17 seconds I have remaining is the assertion that there's no showing on a debatably meritorious claim against the owner of the vehicle. I assert that's absolutely not true. And it goes, this is a hotly contested issue, but I don't think it should be. It goes to counsel tenant's affidavit asserting that Christine Lind owned the vehicle. That's an admission that is on the record and sworn. And there's a lot of controversy over what it means, but if this is an SJ standard or below, we are entitled to have all reasonable inferences drawn in our favor. And that's what I have for you. Thank you.
I want to follow up with the question that actually Judge Johnson asked the respondent, and that is, should we actually be treating respondent Lynn and respondent Davis differently? Because if we just look at the claim against Davis, there it was actually a timely filing, but with regard to Lynn, it was untimely. Can we separate the two out and treat them differently for purposes of this appeal?
It's predictably, I'm going to give you an answer that is the flip side of opposing counsel's coin. I think you can treat them separately. I think they are conceptually distinct, and I think that a separate treatment fits under within the ambit of Rule 504. But I don't think that you reach that here, because I think that debatably meritorious claims are established against both entities, very simply against defendant Lynn for ownership, and then through a chain of evidence involving an initial permittee and a sub-permittee against defendant Davis.
Are you aware of any cases where there's actually been a timely filing with regard to some of the defendants, but not others, that there's been a split in terms of the dismissal for the persons who were subject to the untimely filing?
I found nothing in Minnesota law. I was conscious of the issue in looking and did not see anything. I think if we explored long enough in federal law, we might find something.
All right. Judge Johnson, did you have a question?
Well, I did. I also, it's sort of a comment. I just to clarify my question. I think my question was whether under Rule 60, we could treat the two defendants individually or separately or differently. And I guess I believe that rule 5.04A is relatively clear because it says any action not filed against not filed within 1 year of commencement against any party is deemed dismissed with prejudice against all parties unless blah, blah, blah. So anyway, it seems like rule five accounts for that situation and by its own terms requires the district court to deem the entire case dismissed. And I guess my question for a respondents counsel was whether rule 60 might allow relief on an individualized basis, but in light of the dismissal. I don't know. So I guess in light of that, Mr. Wilson, I'm wondering if you have any additional thoughts or comments.
No, except to say, once again, I think I was wrong and you're right. I think you're right. The analysis is under Rule 60, not under Rule 504. And the rule itself is opaque. I think the analysis would just be, is the judgment a holistic indivisible entity or does it apply independently to the separate litigants? I think probably the latter.
Any further questions? Very good. Well, thank you. Thank you for your excellent arguments and briefing today. We will take this very interesting case under advisement and issue a decision within the set short period of time. Thank you.
Thank you.